Well, thank you for the invitation, Celine, and it's great to be back, at least virtually, in the Bob Room. Hopefully in three dimensions, I'll appear there as my holographic dual next calendar year. Today I'll talk about some relatively recent exciting work done in collaboration with several of my collaborators here at Stanford, but also Yiğit Yargıç from Microsoft Research, who's joining virtually here. So briefly before I jump into the talk, okay, so here's the papers that it's based on, but before I jump into the talk, the basic idea is to try to have the upshot of the gauge gravity duality do something useful for us in a gravitational setting that manifests in the world we see. Now, the gauge gravity duality as a hypothesis is a very useful one because it posits that we get a dimensional discount in studying quantum gravity in some number of dimensions by mapping it to a dual quantum field theory that basically inhabits the boundary of whatever the region, gravitational region we're interested in, and yet captures all the observables of the gravitational theory in the bulk in some way within this quantum field theory. Problem is that its best realizations are all in anti-de Sitter space. Now, I mean, that isn't such a big problem from certain perspective, because it's great to have even one example of a model of quantum gravity thoroughly realized. But of course, there are things about anti-de Sitter space that are quite unlike, say, the observer patch of de Sitter space, which is more akin to the observable universe that we inhabit, we being observers within our cosmic horizon. And in recent work, what we've managed to show is how to extrapolate, in a technical sense, the gauge gravity duality as it's realized in ADS-CFT, that is to deform it, in order to have a model for gravitational physics within the static patch of de Sitter space, at least in 2+1 dimensions. And that's what I'll be talking about today. And so one of the first things that we hear about the gauge gravity duality is that it was motivated by this observation that the entropy of black holes scales with the area of the event horizon, giving us this impression that perhaps there's some thinning of the degrees of freedom, and that if we thought of trying to count local degrees of freedom, that we could get away with counting sort of something sort of sitting on the horizon. That's not actually what happens in ADS-CFT, except in certain contexts. But in the sort of picture that I'll describe today, where we describe a deformation of ADS-CFT, first to describe finite spacetime volume regions within ADS, and then further, with a further deformation to describe the static patch or regions within the static patch in DS, this cartoonish picture becomes quite a little one, and that will allow us to compute the Gibbons-Hawking entropy as a microcanonical count of microstates, basically as a basically the logarithm of the density of states of some quantum system. Before we build up to that, I'll take a step back to the kind of quantum field theory that I'll be discussing, and then I'll put it in context of the gauge gravity duality that that I'll be playing with. So for now, let's look at just two-dimensional quantum field theories deformed by this peculiar operator known as TT-bar. First, what I mean by deformed is that there's a one-parameter family of quantum field theories, roughly thought of as defining this curve on the space of two-dimensional quantum field theories, where the tangent vector at any point is a certain local operator built from components of the stress tensor, as I've shown in the slide. The shorthand for this combination of stress tensors is TT bar. The reason for that is that literally at the CFT point, this combination of stress tensors is just the product of the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic components of the stress tensor. But away from that point, it's really the thing on the right-hand side of the definition sign, the middle part of the equation that I've written here. The initial condition is what we call the seed theory, that is W, the effective action at zero value of the deformation parameter. And what makes this interesting is that the operator TT bar formed from the stress tensor having dimension 2 will be dimension 4. And as such, it is irrelevant in the renormalization group sense. Normally we would say that deforming by an irrelevant operator is a bad idea, that we really shouldn't be able to go much further than perhaps a step along this deformation. But there are some very nice properties of this particular combination or other kinds of combinations of conserved currents in two dimensions that Smirnov and Zamolodchikov showed can actually define a trajectory that can be followed. Now, at the end of this trajectory, the locality properties of the original seed theory are vastly undermined, but nonetheless, there are certain observables that we can track exactly. And these observables will be adequate for the purpose of the exercise of computing the density of states along this deformation. So in pictures, if we took a free theory, then what TT bar does is it dresses the interaction, it gives the free theory an interaction of a very particular type. So in a free theory, there's no scattering, right? And what TT bar does is provides the deformed theory with an S matrix that has the following exponential form. And this exponential form is actually an example of an integrable S matrix. So it satisfies these star triangle relations. And the way TT bar was discovered was actually the reverse of what I'm explaining here. So this exponential is what's known as a CDD phase. And in the context of integrable models, it was known that the various bootstrap relations that allows us to basically write the 2-to-2 S matrix as an object satisfying some set of constraints. So you can use the bootstrap program to constrain this 2-to-2 S matrix, came with an ambiguity up to certain phases. And these momentum dependent phases started with the one that I've written here. And then there are other phases involving higher powers of the momentum that also basically pass through all of the consistency conditions of the bootstrap.
Now, question?
Yes?
Yeah, go for it.
Hello.
Yeah,
you can hear me. Okay, good to see you. Just a question. When you mean by the wedge, simply the epsilon AB tensor contracted.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's what the wedge means. Thank you, Laurent. So the wedge is the epsilon in the space-time indices. A1, A2 is the index on the particle. Right. So now, this in many ways is, yeah, sorry.
I have a question in the chat as well.
Okay.
She's asking, could you describe what the function f might look like? I guess it was from maybe the previous slide.
Determinant f. Oh, sorry. So this is, I was jumping ahead a little bit. F is the, it's the frame field. Determinant f is just the, so d2x determinant f is like the volume form. For reasons I'll explain later, it's nice to use first order variables. I'm doing a bit of a mess here where I have the space-time indices in the operator, and then I have just the the frame field and the determinant. That's just the volume form. So I see another question that just came up in the chat. I mean, I haven't opened it, but I can just answer it.
That's the question I just asked.
Okay, cool. Great, thank you. Thank you, Celine. I hope that's a satisfactory answer. What I noticed with Yeet was that actually there's a very interesting sense in which the effect of this deformation at the level of S matrices can be recovered completely by turning fields seen as functions on this two-dimensional space into some large N matrices, but with a very specific transcription between the matrix indices and the space-time dependence. Now, this transcription is something that I should really credit to Yeet, which is part of a project that we did before, relating certain kinds of matrix integrals to certain kinds of non-local field theories. But basically, if we were to take, say, this field theory, I mean, for now, okay, did all this on the plane, but say we did this on the torus, then in momentum space, well, the momenta are quantized. And say we just looked at the Lagrangian. I'll get to the expressions here, but first, let's just say we looked at the Lagrangian. Every interaction is going to be convolution between some number of fields. And the convolution operation is really just a product between infinite Toeplitz matrices. Toeplitz matrices are matrices that are constant along the diagonal, meaning the matrix entry phi ij depends only on I minus j. Now, so there's this nice relation between the convolution and the matrix product between Toeplitz matrices. And now say the matrices were not Toeplitz anymore, right? If we drop that constraint, then in addition to the index difference, we have the index sum. And if we were associating one of the momentum components to the index difference, then the right thing to associate to the index sum turns out to be the position along the other direction, roughly speaking. If we do a Fourier transform of the index sum, then in the two-dimensional momentum space, the convolution turns into a star product. And that star product, written in terms of matrix components, in terms of momentum components, is basically of the following kind at the very bottom line of the slide, where we have the exponential phases exactly of the kind that appear in the TT bar deformed S matrices that appear just in the algebra of operator products. So what TT bar is doing, the reason why it's universal, is that it is taking local sort of Poincaré invariant two-dimensional field theories and basically changing the algebra of like pointwise multiplication of functions to a certain star product algebra, which has the algebraic properties of a matrix product. And when written in momentum space, it gives rise to these exponential phases. And to see exactly the in equations, the picture that was drawn two slides ago, let's try and do a TT bar dressing of the number one. Now, there are many ways to write the number one. The way I'll choose today is to look at the LSE reduction formula applied to a time-ordered product of an even number of free field operators. Now, this is just a textbook way of seeing why the S matrix for free theories one is because this time-ordered product is going to be a product of propagators, which then multiplied by the kinetic terms on the left, as dictated by LSE, will all cancel. The on-shell condition makes no difference. We just get the overlap between the vacuum states, which is one, seeing as how it's normalized. Under TT-bar, however, if we accept that the rule is to change the pointwise product between functions to the star product or the star convolution, then we can't just use Wick's theorem to write the time-ordered product as a product of propagators. We first need to filter out the momentum-dependent phases that the star products induce, and then apply the usual time-ordered product rule to the pointwise products. And that is how we derive the TT bar deformed phases, scattering phases of our previously free theory. So this was noticed first by Dubovsky, Gorbenko, and Mirbabai, that even outside the realm of integrable theories, TT bar would dress the S matrix of a given theory by exactly this pattern of exponential phases. And Yeet and I were able to recover this basically by noting that we're taking local field theories and replacing them with matrix integrals. So this was a fun paper that we wrote. And for more, yeah, you can ask me later. This is just to give a feeling for the kinds of theories that will live on the boundary. So they're quite peculiar, and they have these these bizarre properties.
But, just a question.
Yeah, sure.
There's a special role played by the index L in the last formula. So what is it? Do you have a...
Oh, L and N? Yeah, so that's just split between the ingoing and out.
Ingoing and...
Yeah, so it doesn't really matter. I mean, if you wanted, you could take the convention where they're all outgoing.
Okay.
Through crossing symmetry, yeah. So yeah, thank you for that question.
Should I think of the big N in the last, the slide before that? Yeah. Should I think of that as a regular on some mode?
So really, I mean, I really want to take it to infinity. I just wanted to write this as a, you know, I just wanted to write a matrix. That's why I put this beginning. I really want to take that to infinity. If I do truncate, then it is a regulator. But for the purpose of all of this working, it doesn't really matter that these, well, you can still make sense of what the matrix product is, even if you have infinite matrices. So you're right that if I did have n be finite, that would be a regulator. But I want this to really be in the large n limit.
I'm sorry, but the index is continuous or discrete? Because the x0
right.
is 1.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So if this was really on the torus, so it's we will take it to be continuous for the purpose of making sense of scattering states. But it's in much the same vein as when you have... So if you really were to think about having some spacetime be a torus, and then you wanted to ask about the S matrix anyway, then you're really only going to be able to do this in the case where you don't actually notice that there are two sort of closed cycles. So you're looking at momenta that are sufficiently large in comparison to the characteristic scale set by the radius of the cycle. So you can look at it as being effectively continuous. The point really is that even if these index labels are continuous, the algebraic properties of the star product are effectively the same as those of the matrix product. So the literal equivalence only really holds when the momenta are discrete, when we're doing this strictly on the torus. But on the plane, this is a little bit more of an inspiration. The formula that's actually exact is the formula for the star product. Yeah. Cool. Okay, so let's go back to holography. So the nice thing about Titibar that Megaw, Meze, and Berlinde noticed was that under this deformation, we basically take the if we start with the holographic CFD dual to ADS quantum gravity, then under this deformation, the effect on the bulk is to move the boundary inwards. And this deformation parameter lambda sets the amount by which the overall spacetime volume is reduced. So this simple picture is in many ways one step towards making or you know, like having a holographic dictionary that could at some point be useful for a finite spacetime volume region like the observer patch in De Sitter. We'll see exactly how, but for now we'll take finite volume ADS3. And here I'll just explain what the basic observable that we're matching between the bulk and the boundary will be, which then will carry over to the De Sitter case. So excited.
So typically, I like to think about going into the bulk as being the IR, right? But here you're sort of saying I never thought about this Titibar story, so might be a very simple question, but how does going into the UV with Titibar take you inwards into the bulk? Like how do I reconcile the intuition that the bulk, going into the bulk is the IR with this Titibar story?
That's a good point. So there are two senses in which you could go into the bulk. Now, in the holographic RG sense, this purple cylinder is it's not really a surface of any significance. It's a line you draw, and you basically glue together an IR part of the gravitational path integral within that cylinder, and then you glue that with some annular part connecting the UV to that surface. And then you sort of move this as an IR cutoff in the bulk and a UV cutoff in the boundary. So there's this old Heemskerk-Polchinski story. And indeed, like literally moving, right? If you are doing an experiment and you literally have, you know, some excitations that you know, travel into the bulk, they're basically going to start losing energy. You have warping as you move into the bulk. And that's why that's kind of the IR. But now, if you literally cut off, so if you think of the purple cylinder as literally being a smaller cylinder, then what you've done is you've really changed what the UV behavior of the theory is. Because remember, if you're massless, you bounce off the boundary, right? And you need to first of all be energetic enough to reach the boundary, and then you sort of bounce off of it because of the boundary condition. Now, what happens is that you're just going to be a lot more energetic if you're confined to a smaller cylinder. In other words, you sort of changed the UV boundary condition by deforming by TT bar. You've brought what would have otherwise been very high energy closer. You see what I mean, roughly speaking? Yeah, so from the perspective of probes within the bulk, you can kind of work out that this is what it means to actually have a system where the UV is defined by TT bar, and actually the CFT behavior is in the IR, right? So as you follow the RG flow, this thing is just getting bigger and bigger, meaning you're going deeper and deeper into the bulk, right? As an observer within the bulk. And as far as you're concerned, the fact that this purple cylinder was not asymptotic infinity is kind of an irrelevant point, right? So that's kind of the way to make sense of this. That helps. But yeah, thank you for the question, Gio. Right. So now,
So the TT bar, it lives on the boundary, of course. So the TT bar action itself is a boundary term according to Carden. Boundary are we talking about?
I see. So indeed, there's a sense in which you could write TT bar as a boundary term, and Cardi uses that in order to be able to do things like dress correlation functions and so on. But if you look into exactly what kind of boundary term it is, it'll be something peculiar and non-local. So Cardi's prescription to dress correlation functions by writing TT bar as basically like the curl of something else, and then, you know, being very clever with the translation word identity and so on, is just like a Fourier transform of this expression. A Fourier transform of this kind of expression, not when applied to S matrices, but when applied to correlation functions. So I wouldn't say that like thinking about TT bar itself as a local boundary term is the right intuition. It's really like that trick involves writing it as some kind of non-local boundary term. That's I guess the answer. If you wanted, that behavior would become more apparent if we were to look at, say, Cauchy slice, like a Cauchy slice running through the bulk, and then you would have the junction between this cutoff surface and the Cauchy slice, and you would have this non-local corner piece from the bulk, or this non-local boundary term from the perspective of the boundary, manifest itself at that junction. But the fact that it's non-local just makes it not quite like the boundary terms we're mostly used to.
But maybe, you're maybe going to talk about it. But there's a sense in which, from the gravitational perspective, there's a boundary here, a real boundary in which this flow equation can be understood as some radial Wheeler de Witt equation.
Correct. Yeah. We'll get to that. But indeed, you can take that perspective and go one step further, as Aaron Wall and collaborators have in the past couple of years. And you can literally map states in the CFD, which are co-dimension one objects with respect to the, you know, the space on which the CFD lives, to actual, not radial, but like actual really good wave functions in the bulk too. I mean, I'm not gonna, yeah, I don't have an expression for that in the slides, but yeah, we could totally discuss that at some point. So yes, there's a sense in which, information about the bulk gravitational constraints is implicit in the structure of this deformation. But right now we're going to do a little bit more of a modest matching between observables on either side. So normally what we would do in ADS CFD with asymptotic boundaries is compute the energy, the ADM energy, and match it to the energy of the CFD put on a cylinder, right? So if you have heavy states, then their energy matches the ADM energy corresponding to a BTZ black hole living inside this asymptotically ADS space. Now, what happens when the boundary is not at asymptotic infinity is that we have to compute on the bulk so-called quasi-local energy. And this quasi-local energy formula takes the following form for a black hole of mass m and angular momentum j, and with a cutoff surface of radius rc. Now, under the TT bar deformation, what we can do is follow what happens to the energy levels of the CFD defined on the cylinder under the deformation. Now, the integrability preservation property of this deformation has as a corollary the fact that every energy level flows to another without any crossing. So this deformation deforms energy level to energy level. And the formula that tells you how that happens is the following first order differential equation with respect to the deformation parameter mu, known as the Burgers, which is called the Burgers equation because it looks like the Burgers equation of fluid mechanics without the viscosity term. Now, with CFD initial conditions, we can actually integrate this equation to find E as a function of mu and the radius of the cylinder, which I call big L. And the answer you get has the following form. Now, here we see that there's a choice to be made of the sign within the square root, which is essentially the sign of this deformation parameter mu. In order to match the quantity computed in the bulk, this quasi-local energy, and also to make any other match, including of the kind that Laurent was saying, which is between the flow equation and the radial relativity equation, we need to take the minus sign of this mu. So the matching basically is that we take the minus sign and we make the usual identifications between the energy on the cylinder and the ADM mass and the angular momentum on either side. We take L to be RC over 4G and we get an exact mapping between these two formulae. And this was done in Megomez and Verlinde's paper. Now, what I'll say is that this is literally the only match we need. This is the only bulk and boundary sort of match we need in order to track what happens to the density of states and to talk about the entropy and so on. And this is what we'll leverage in the de Sitter portion of this talk, but I will not go there before the honorary mention of Laurent's formula that came like 8 years before anybody was talking about TT bar or any of this, which is the following expression that says that if we take the CFD generating function as a function of the geometry it lives on, and then convolve it with a kernel that is given in the exponential by the determinant of E minus F, where F is the frame field that the object psi depends on, then what we find is that the radial relativity equation being satisfied by psi is a consequence of the conformal void identity being satisfied by the generating function. And the only addition, in a sense, that recent literature has made to this insight is the fact that the kinetic term of the relativity equation is actually defining the expectation value of the TT bar operator, and that this equation is really like the Kalman-Simoncic equation for a CFD deformed by TT bar. So Laurent kind of knew this all along. This is a very nice formula. We have now some generalizations of this, at least in the semi-classical regime in the bulk in higher dimensions. I won't get to talk about that much, but if you're interested, we can talk about it later. What we've failed to do so far is find the generalization of this to the De Sitter case that I'll describe. But yeah, that would be a very exciting development in this field.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the sign of this lambda being positive is kind of baked in, so it's making mu in the previous slides negative. So even for this match, that sign issue is an important one. Anyway, what Gorbenko, Silverstein, and Toroba noticed was that if we added to this irrelevant deformation, a P is proportional to essentially the identity operator. It's like a cosmological constant operator off the boundary, which they called lambda 2. Lambda 2 standing for a cosmological constant in two dimensions, just in the boundary dimensions. Then this overall flow actually tells us something about gives us a dual description to DS bulk physics. But first, just to describe what this general flow equation means, I've put this parameter eta here to give us the option to switch between the ADS and DS cases. It's when eta is zero, it's the DS case. When eta is one, it's the ADS case, because that'll drop out. Now, how we set the initial condition for this flow, because you see lambda here appears in the denominator in the second term, is that we actually set it at some finite value of the deformation parameter. So we set the initial condition for the TT bar plus lambda 2 flow at some finite TT bar deformation. So this W lambda C.
Since recently there's a lot of interest in the asymptotically flat, is there a beta where you can recover asymptotic flat, or it's not in that
sure. space? No, you could. You really could. The subtlety there is to understand how to take this time-like surface and then relate it. So, the thing that you get here is some time-like Dirichlet wall enclosing finite volume. You could take this eta and then tune it to some in-between value where it just cancels bulk cosmological constant, and you're in flat space, as in you're in lambda equals zero. But you need to then also figure out what the order of limits is to make this Dirichlet wall sort of as big as the asymptotically flat region. And then you basically have some construction that will roughly look like, you know, if you were doing stretched horizon, but instead of the horizon, you have like scry plus union scry minus, something like that. We haven't done that yet. There is a paper where this lambda equals zero regime has been studied very recently by Ronak Soni, Evan Coleman, and Sang-Yuan Yang in the context of holographic entanglement entropy. But yeah, this is one of the action items in this research field. So yeah, thank you for the question. Now, the picture in the bulk, which Eva Gonzalo and Victor found, was that actually this TT bar plus lambda 2 deformed CFT sits on a finite Dirichlet wall, not in ADS anymore, but really in DS. So you really have positive cosmological constant in the bulk. And if you take this deformation to a certain extreme value, this thing can essentially hug the cosmic horizon. So at any finite value of the deformation parameter, what it's actually doing is it's covering a patch between the cosmic horizon and some Dirichlet wall, or the interior of a Dirichlet wall within this positive cosmological constant region. And the initial condition determines which of these two fillings we actually see. So I'll get to that. I was a little bit fast with that. But the basic picture is that the bulk of interest here is the static patch of De Sitter at ES3. The boundary, which is depicted by one of these orangish lines, is in Lorentzian signature a cylinder, a time-like cylinder, which in Euclidean signature is going to be a torus. And in the extreme limit, where we take this to the horizon, we have that the non-contractible cycle of this torus shrinks to zero size. So, you know, roughly speaking, you have something that kind of has the topology of a disk instead of a torus at the horizon. But now the thing is that in this picture, this wedge I've drawn, there are two ways to think about how one of these lines could be a boundary. You either fill it in from the horizon inwards, or you fill the interior of one of these tubes. And those correspond to two kinds of initial conditions we can set for this flow. Before we get to that, what we have here is, again, a more general kind of Berger's equation, which I've written in terms of dimensionless quantities compared to what we had before. And we have a general solution for it as a function of eta. And so this will give us the quantity we need to then track the density of states. And I'll explain how that happens. Now, if we take eta equals minus one, as in if we're in the De Sitter case, then we have these two patches. The first, which was studied by Gorbenko, Silverstein, and Doroba, called the pole patch, where you basically fill in the interior of this world tube. How you do that is you start in ADS, you drive the TT bar deformation to some very large value of the deformation, and then you use that very highly deformed theory as an initial condition to then do this TT bar plus lambda 2 flow. So that's the sense in which you start from a very skinny world tube, and along the TT bar plus lambda 2 flow, this world tube fattens and covers more and more of the interior of the cosmic horizon. The second alternative is basically to look at a state. So this one makes best sense if you think about it in terms of a particular state in the CFD. And that's the state which in the bulk corresponds to a black hole with horizon size of LADS. And then we do TT bar deformation up to a certain critical value, which is what brings the cutoff surface all the way to the horizon. And then we do the TT bar plus lambda 2 deformation. And what that does is it takes us to the following patch where we fill in from the outside into this world tube. In other words, here we're looking at it's kind of like the dominant saddle when we consider the problem of having a so-called York boundary, a finite time-like boundary surrounded by cosmic horizon. So these are sort of two complementary prescriptions corresponding to two kinds of initial conditions that we can set for this flow. We will see how actually these two are just S dual of each other in the Euclidean signature. And the energy formulae have some differences in the sign, basically, between these two patches. And once again, the quantity is just quasi-local energy. That's what we're computing in the bulk. And then that just corresponds to the deformed energy on the boundary, following the flow equation in exactly the way we did it in the pure TT bar case, now including this lambda 2 contribution. Now, as I said, when you approach the horizon, in the picture where we fill in the interior of the world tube, it corresponds to the case where this non-contractible cycle starts to shrink. And this fact was noted by Sunita Varadarajan in a paper in 2002 for some reasons, but that insight will actually help in the calculation that we're going to do. And that's sort of the way to think about the Euclidean DST horizon from the pole patch perspective. And basically that's, so this is just a summary of what that setting is. And this is the explicit formula for the quasi-local energy within this world tube. Now, in some sense, you should expect that this patch, unless we actually go and hug the horizon, should see no entropy, right? If we're talking about a microcanonical entropy, we actually need some finite density of states, right? So we need something which is a quite dense spectrum for this to be able to capture something like an entropy. So with just this world tube, we won't be able to capture anything like the Gibbons-Hawking entropy. So we really need to push it out all the way to the horizon to have some chance. Now we're in better position, we're better situated to try to actually compute the Gibbons-Hawking entropy when we're looking at the so-called cosmic horizon patch. Because here we're really starting with the cosmic horizon and we're sort of flowing towards this very thin world tube. So basically we have a setting where we have a world tube surrounded by a horizon. And so what we need to do in order to get the rest of the static patch is to shrink this world tube. And the end result of this actually has some interesting sort of resonance with other things in the literature. Specifically, there's papers, recent papers by Jacobson, Visser, Bani Hashimi, and others, where they've studied these York boundaries and quasi-local thermodynamics in De Sitter, where this is exactly the picture they land on. And also there's this work by Witten, Longo, Chandrasekharan, and Pennington, where they argue that in order to really understand how the sort of von Neumann algebra associated to quantum field theory and De Sitter is of type 2-1, you need, in addition to the De Sitter static patch, to include a world line's worth of degrees of freedom. So they call that the observer, and that's just looks very much like this very thin world tube that we get at the end of this flow. So I thought that would be good to mention. Now here we have a an energy formula where it depends on this why not, and why not is basically the matching point. It's the point where we set the initial condition for the flow. And how to actually think about this why not, as I mentioned before, is that we start in ADS with a black hole. So we start with the BTZ solution, but with the BTZ solution where the horizon radius equals LADS. And now there's this very trivial fact, which is that A over 4G for that black hole equals A over 4G for the cosmic horizon if LADS equals LDS. Now, this is pure numerology. And what we've managed to do is find a quantum field theory that substantiates this numerology. But the first point is that the near horizon geometries of this R equals L BTZ black hole and the R equals L surface in De Sitter, i.e. the cosmic horizon, are identical. And basically the metrics are essentially the same. You'd have to go to a subleading order in sort of distance away from the horizon in order to see the differences. And that's what's set by this eta w squared term. And that's why this is a good surface at which we can essentially match the quasi-local energies, right? So the quasi-local energies of these two systems are the same. And if you asked about excited states upon making that match, what would happen is that we would have these funny domain walls between a sort of region with negative cosmological constant and a region with positive cosmological constant. And there it's basically that the, since we picked, so if it was for the delta equals C over six level for which this matching is complete, right? We can get the entire static patch. And if delta is less than C over six, for the very same reason, because we've made the match already, we can't quite get them to sort of uniformly all live within a region of positive cosmological constant. And there will be this domain wall junction with a negative cosmological constant region. And well, these states are completely subdominant in the entropy calculation. And if we pick a holographic CFT with a sparse light spectrum, then that's certainly the case. And so they don't really contribute. Now, if we wanted to really complete this holographic prescription, we would have to do additional double trace deformations with the operators of these conformal dimensions in order to have a perfect match between the bulk and the boundary and not have to have these funny domain walls. So in a sense, if we're really going to look at these matter sectors, essentially, then this is an incomplete prescription. But for the purpose of computing the Gibbons-Hawking entropy, even to include its first logarithmic correction, turns out that these states don't matter. Now, the very interesting thing is that really we should think about the ensemble that we're interested in, the sort of gravitational ensemble, to contain both of these patches. And there's actually a sort of Hawking-Page-like transition between them. Now, if we were to look at all of this in the Euclidean picture, then, as I said, these world tubes will become tori. And in one picture, the non-contractible cycle is the one that shrinks as you approach the cosmic horizon, whereas in the other, that basically corresponds to the contractible cycle shrinking. Right? So again, it's because in one picture, the world tube is becoming infinitely thin. And the other picture is becoming really large, but if we were to identify time periodically, then basically the non-contractible cycle is becoming extremely small as we approach the horizon. So these are S-dual to each other. And indeed, because the flow equation is just a rewriting of like the relativity equation, there is the sort of symmetry under the mapping class group that it does respect, the equation does respect. And what we're seeing here is the action of that symmetry on specific solutions to this flow equation. And so if we were to think about this as an ensemble, then what we should really do is look at the maximum between these two options. And we'll basically see that there's going to be a crossover around beta equals L between the two ways of filling, right? So from the boundary perspective, this is just some theory, some disembodied the surface, and there's a theory living on it. Question in the holographic dictionary is what the bulk picture is. And that's where you have these two options, and these two options are basically competing energetically with each other in the ensemble. You need to actually include both of them. And there's a crossover at a certain point between one and the other. Specifically, if we're going to take the high temperature limit, which is what we want to do from the right-hand side perspective, to actually cover the entire static patch, then what we find is that we capture, just from looking at the leading contribution to the generating function in the semi-classical limit, we capture the Cardi density of states, so the logarithm of the Cardi density of states, in other words, the Cardi entropy of our undeformed CFD with delta equals C over 6 minus beta times the energy level corresponding to that C over 6 undeformed state as a function of L. And as beta goes to 0, this right-hand contribution goes to 0, and you only have the Cardi formula computing the entropy for us. Now, this is just a long-winded way of talking about a very basic fact in Euclidean gravitational thermodynamics that Gibbons and Hawking themselves noted, which was that if you have no boundaries, then the gravitational path integral should compute should only give you an entropy contribution. So this is how they basically argued that the cosmic horizon should have an entropy to begin with, because they say, well, okay, in Euclidean signatures, this is a sphere. There are no boundaries. We just compute the path integral. But the fact that there are no boundaries means that we can't really associate an energy. There's no free energy contribution. There's only really going to be, there's no pure energy contribution. There's only going to be an entropy contribution. And so if you just take the action on shell, call it the entropy, identify the de Sitter temperature, then you get A over 4G of the cosmic horizon being the entropy of the cosmic horizon. How we're seeing that is we're actually putting, so the best to see this in the left-hand picture, left-hand from my perspective, is to see that we have an ensemble, a sort of gravitational ensemble, of geometries filled in up to a time-like Dirichlet wall surrounded by a cosmic horizon, right? And then you ask, what happens in the limit where this time-like Dirichlet wall shrinks? This Dirichlet wall provides both an entropy and an energy contribution to this ensemble, but the energy contribution to this ensemble goes to zero as this wall shrinks to become this kind of skinny neighborhood of a world tube. And there you sort of recover this Gibbons-Hawking story that, well, you have no boundary in the Euclidean picture, so all you really can associate with the action on shell, that is the leading contribution to the gravitational path integral, is an entropy. So that's essentially the calculation. You basically go to the high temperature limit from the perspective of this pole patch, which in the cosmic horizon patch corresponds to shrinking the world tube all the way to a world line. And the formula that we have for the generating function, when appropriately seen as the maximum between the two generating functions of either patch, is that we get the Cardi density of states at level C over 6, which computes to pi C over 3, which in the bulk is A over 4G for the cosmic horizon. So this is how we get the density of states from just knowing how the energy is deformed. Now, the picture really is that this integrable flow means that there's no level crossing, as I mentioned. So what it looks like roughly, sort of schematically, if I was just following a few levels, is that if we had this blue spectrum on the left-hand side in the CFD, so y equals zero, meaning at zero value of the deformation parameter, and then we did some TT bar flow up to some critical value of y, right, which is 3 over c pi squared, and then you added this lambda 2 deformation and continued to flow, then at no point will any of these levels cross. In particular, if you look at the density of these states, that really never changes, right? So basically, the density of states of your original undeformed CFD is just going along for the ride because of the integrable nature of this deformation. And so if you wanted to think about the truncated Hilbert space of all real levels, that is the levels that will stay real under this deformation, then there's this level C over 6, and we put a cutoff at C over 6 plus delta to maintain the reality of this of the energy spectrum. There are some subleading model-dependent light states, which have a density of states that are sum of delta functions. Whereas starting from C over 6, we have the Cardy formula applying. Now, in normal CFDs, also at very high energies, we have the Cardy formula applying to give us the density of states. This is how Cardy originally derived the entropy formula, by looking at an asymptotic limit. The specialty of a holographic CFD is that this formula can be applied at finite levels. So sort of like you can, it has an extended regime of validity. This extended regime of validity of the Cardy formula can be seen as a characteristic feature of a holographic theory. In particular, it starts at delta equals C over 6. And if I were to write the rest of the spectrum here, it would just be this dense continuum, almost continuum of states. And so this slice will basically flow all the way under this deformation to give us, in the TT bar plus lambda 2 case, the Gibbons-Hawking entropy. And in equations, what that means is that if we looked at the relation, so between the microcanonical and canonical ensembles, which is a Laplace transformation, then under this deformation, what basically happens is that we're re-expressing the undeformed density of states in terms of the deformed energy levels. So it gains a dependence on the deformation parameter y purely by dint of this inversion. But in many ways, it is just the same density of states. So that's why when you take y to a critical value, it goes to a certain constant, which is just pi c over 3. And in fact, you can run this argument and include the leading log correction and find that actually, in addition to the leading c pi over 3, because of how much control we have on the CFT side, knowing exactly what even the leading log corrections are, we basically find that the correction to the leading gravitational A over 4G result is 3 times the log of A over 4G, which again agrees with what you would compute naively from just taking the bulk path integral. And there's a nice paper by Sen where it was argued that it's the fluctuation sectors that will give rise to this, and it's basically completely consistent with that. So the final result is that we've managed to compute the entropy of the cosmic horizon as a microcanonical density of states. So logarithm of a microcanonical density of states. And what allowed us to do that was the integrable nature of this deformation and the fact that the structure of the flow equation mapped onto the radial constraint equations in a De Sitter space, in basically the interior of the cosmic horizon of De Sitter space. So, then we can ask, like, okay, if this is what happens in two dimensions, if we then go and generalize this deformation to higher dimensions, semi-classically, we can still follow what happens. And indeed, we do find that, like, for ADS black hole with R equals L, you do have the same density of states giving rise to the cosmic horizon entropy. But of course, the distinction is that we can't get any of the subleading stuff because the original theory is not integrable. There's no notion of integrability anymore. This flow equation works nice and level by level only in the large n limit. So one over n effects are quite complicated. And there's also black holes in the Sitter space, which we need to look at a little bit more carefully and understand what their undeformed counterparts are. But yeah, that was what I wanted to say.
Thank you very much, Vasu, for your talk. Do students have questions? On Zoom as well, if you have a question, you can just unmute yourself or raise your hand.
Sorry, let me just, yeah, it's easier for me to toggle through Zoom if I do that.
If not, if anyone has a question, there is someone asking, could you please comment on what kind of effects we can find in Broken Formal Theories?
Well, that's a very good question. I should say that we haven't really studied those, but I am very curious about whether we could leverage stuff like localization. I think that in higher dimensions, if you wanted to understand some 1 over n resummed results, then maybe that's like the best bet is to try to, you know, rely on some mechanism like localization. But it's very peculiar because, I mean, this lambda d deformation is going to break supersymmetry, I suspect. The pure TT bar deformation, at least on shell, I wouldn't expect it to break supersymmetry. The right thing to do would be to do a deformation involving some supercurrent squared type operator. And that's, yeah, a thing that, yeah, it's an aspiration. We aren't there yet. But yeah, thank you for the question.
Okay. Yeah.
So you were describing thermodynamic competition in that's an analogous to Hawking phase transition for
yes.
Different. I mean, typically we understand that at the level of like actual Euclidean solutions,
right?
Satellites compete thermodynamically. But so is there any? So you had a Lorentzian picture. Is there any Euclidean understanding of like how?
This is truly you should really think about this as all folded up. I mean, the it's easy to draw as a Lorentzian picture, but and maybe you can say that because we can write this partition function as a trace of some e to the minus beta h, there's some phase space sense in which there is a Lorentzian picture. But very honestly, in the gravitational sense, you should really think about this as some kind of completely Euclidean calculation. So I wouldn't be very comfortable saying that we know how to get all this from some Lorentzian path integral prescription. What we can do is define all these. So we can define this generating function as we can define this partition function as trace e to the minus beta h. So you know there's some phase space that we've identified associated with these quasi-local quantities, and some people use Lorentzian path integral interchangeably with phase space path integral. But I mean, I don't know if that's actually the right way to think about the Lorentzian path integral. So I'll sort of just step back and say that the pictures are easy to draw in the Lorentzian case. But really what this is some, it's some Euclidean fact in much the same way as the original Hawking phase transition is some Euclidean fact.
But there's no understanding of that. Which contribute the Euclidean solutions?
Oh, I mean, like as far as Euclidean solutions are concerned, yeah. I mean, this is that's what we do understand. What we don't understand is actually the Lorentzian story. Is what I'm trying to say. Because here, you know, the thing that you would do in the bulk is compute the Euclidean path integral up to some cutoff surface, either in one way or the other, right? Like these kinds of fillings, I can only really make sense of them, strictly speaking, in terms of the Euclidean path integral. I don't actually know what it means in the Lorentzian case. So in much the same way as we would take something like BTZ and we would take like thermal ADS, there we're basically looking at like, you know, different ways of sort of filling solid torus, right? And you have like two different ways of switching it up. Here, you basically have a very similar thing, except that, except that now you don't, I mean, the DS is not really a like the static patch is not really a solid torus, right? It's really kind of a hemisphere. It's really a sphere. So it's some funny vibration of tori over the sphere. But in terms of the boundary calculation, it is indeed just two hollow tori with, you know, with different ways of patching them up together. So that's where I can responsibly tell this story. So it is Euclidean. Only the pictures are Lorentzian. So yeah.
Thank you.
Another question?
Let me just pin the bob room so I can see who this is.
Yeah, I think there is no more question. So I suggest we thanks again, Basil, for your talk. Thank you very much.